Well, good morning. This is Per Fagering, Fight the Empire. And our guest today is Ann Jones, who's the author. She's a writer and a photographer, author of War Is Not Over When It's Over. And before that, a book called Kabul in Winter. And a recent article last month, she wrote an article for the Tom Dispatch called Why Peace is the Business of Man, but Shouldn't Be. So, Ann Jones, welcome to KABU.
Thank you.
Why don't we start out with tell us about Security Council Resolution 1325.
Ah, that much neglected Security
totally ignored.
Council resolution. That was passed in 2000, October 31st of the year 2000. And it's a very important resolution that at the time was hailed as really a great advance toward promoting world peace. And it holds basically that every peace negotiation, every bit of peace building and reconstruction after conflict should include women in substantial numbers at the negotiating tables, participating every step of the way in those peace processes. And the reason the Security Council passed this resolution was very clear that, usually when a war ends, they get together the guys who have been fighting, the representatives from the various sides, or most of them, come together at the negotiating table and kind of split up the power and the proceeds and the natural resources and agree to quit shooting at each other, and they call that peace. But those agreements, which are commonly made everywhere in the world, tend to fall apart very quickly, and countries fall back into civil war. We see that process going on right now in Côte d'Ivoire. So the Security Council reasoned that the men who make war may be good at making war, but they're really terrible at trying to make peace. And if you want to make a peace that will last, you have to include representatives of the civil society, and that chiefly means women, who not only make up half the population, but also try to safeguard the rights of their children. So when women come to the table, they represent all those interests like shelter, clean water, health care, education, and so on. All those interests that not only women and children, but peaceable men need in order to live in lives of reasonable peace. So it just makes good common sense to get the women in there, having their say, speaking up for their kids and for their peaceable husbands in trying to negotiate the future of their countries. But in the years that have passed, more than a decade now, since this resolution was passed by the UN Security Council, it has never been put into effect anywhere in the world.
Yeah, well, you write in your article that in Afghanistan, a misogyny is not a traditional value. You talk about the back in the 20s, King Amanullah brought about various moves towards gender equality, and then, of course, later so did the communists. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we have this idea, and especially American men who don't seem to get it, the Afghan experts keep saying that Afghanistan is a traditional culture and there's really not much you can do above and beyond what we've already done to try to safeguard the rights of women. But, by traditional culture, men mean a culture in which women don't have any rights. And to some extent, that's true in Afghanistan, but it is also not true. It's not the one and only tradition. And ever since King Amanullah tried to put into effect his very progressive program, establishing education for women, banning the veil. He unveiled his own queen. Ever since he tried to do those things, these disputes about women's equality and progressive democratic impulses in the society, modernizing impulses in the society, have really been at the heart of the cultural struggles within Afghanistan. There has always been, or at least for better than a century now, a strong progressive element within the country. And those progressive elements have most of the time been the leaders of the country. But you also have the more conservative tradition. Now, when we decide as Americans with a great deal of influence there, when we decide that the sole tradition in Afghanistan is the oppression of women, that's not accurate. We are, in fact, choosing to take sides with the worst of Afghan tradition, to the exclusion of those progressive elements in the country. And you know, the thing that we really fail to realize as a simple, practical, political truth in Afghanistan is that all these women who are now out there working for women's rights, those who are going to school, those who are sending their girls to school, those who are holding jobs, all those women are doing that with the backing of the men in their families, a husband, a father, their sons, their brothers, their uncles. If the men are not on the side of the women, those women are not going to get out of the house. So every woman who's out there fighting for her rights is actually fighting for the rights of that whole progressive democratic element in Afghan society, men and women together. Mm-hmm. So when we simply give up on women and let the men make the most extremely conservative elements of men on both sides come to the peace table and try to make something called peace, we've just abandoned everything that we say we're fighting for.
Well, you know, this progressive tradition continued under the communist rulers, but then around 1979, the U.S. decided getting rid of the Marxists was so important that the U.S. supported these Islamic extremists.
Yes.
And then they sort of turned on us, but we're still trying to make up to them.
Well, some of them turned on us, but some of them are the very guys that we put into power in the government. The extremists are on both sides right now. Some of the extremists are the Taliban we say we're fighting against, and other extremists are in the Karzai government, and they're in the parliament. And so we really have set this up so that whichever side seems to win, the progressive and democratic elements in Afghanistan will lose. We went in, you're quite right, we sort of tempted the Soviets to invade, and we, together with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, of course, armed these mujahideen and kept them fighting against the Soviets in this prolonged and really brutal proxy war for a decade. But we did that on the what now seems like a crazy Cold War belief that if you are fighting against godless communism, who better to have as the allies of a Christian nation than these devout Islamists? Mm-hmm. You know, somebody, we reasoned at the time, or that is the you know, at the time, Bill Casey was in charge of the CIA, and he was himself a very devout Catholic. So he thought that the logical allies for devout Catholics would be devout Muslims. And that's why we picked out these Muslim extremists who actually had already been driven out of their country into exile. We supported them to go back into the country and fight against the Soviets. But surprise, surprise, the Islamist extremists turn out to have an agenda of their own, which is, as we know, very anti-American. So we have, in a way, created the so-called monsters that haunt us today. And we were warned. Many people warned the U.S. government at the time that we were creating our own worst enemy. And of course, those predictions came true.
Well, you know, speaking of monsters, this is from an article in the San Francisco Chronicle from last August, and it's called Afghanistan's Dirty Little Secret. And the writer, Joel Brinkley, he writes about these Afghan warlords who have what they call dancing boys.
Oh, yes.
A sociologist named Anna Maria Cardinale studied this thing. And I'll just read one little bit. Sociologists and anthropologists say the problem results from perverse interpretation of Islamic law. Women are simply unapproachable. Afghan men cannot talk to an unrelated woman until after proposing marriage. Before that, they can't even look at a woman except perhaps her feet. Otherwise, she is covered head to ankle. How can you fall in love if you can't see her face, one man asked. And this sort of continues after marriage, too. And then the article quotes an Afghan expression, quote, women are for children, boys are for pleasure. Now, this was taken from an ancient Greek aphorism. So this is just very strange.
Pedophilia is rampant in most of the world. I mean, mm-hmm. We have our share of pedophiles here. Americans are probably numerically the greatest number of sex tourists in many parts of the world, cruising for sex with children, many of them cruising for sex with young boys. So you don't want to make too much of the fact that, you know, pedophilia is quite popular in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not alone in that.
Right.
But I do think that, any culture that is so intent upon, or where elements of the culture are so intent upon keeping the sexes completely separate, and where men look down upon women as inferior to them, where are they going to go for their enjoyment? And the dancing boys are quite a tradition. They are dressed up as kind of fake girls, though, mm-hmm. In most cases, although many dancing boys dance as boys as well. So it's very widespread, but it is in many parts of the world.
Well, I think it's sort of like a warrior culture thing. You know, there's also this idea that women who are menstruating are unclean. Now, this is not limited to Islam. It's true of other religions, too. And I got this amazing quote, talk about the Washington warlords. This is from Newsmax, which is a very conservative website, and they are pushing this kind of a exercise program called Powers, promoting what they call the triple alpha male. And it's just bizarre. They say, do you want to be the kind of man who earns automatic respect the moment he strides into the room? Do you want to exude an aura of physical magnetism and invincibility that shouts leader to all present? Well, it just goes on and on. They're serious, but it's so funny, you know? So,
well, it sounds a lot like the Marine recruiters. You know, that's fairly commonplace, this notion of the super male. But you know, the problem with the if we go back to thinking about Afghanistan and this, the whole process of making peace there, is not just the problem in trying to make a peace is not just because of certain biases or traditions or prejudices of Afghan men. The misogyny that excludes women from the peace process and the peace table comes out of Washington just as strongly as it comes out of Afghanistan. I mean, here we have a female Secretary of State, and Hillary Clinton has taken a strong stand. Over and over again, she has announced that she will not allow the women of Afghanistan to be abandoned, that they will be provided for, and their rights will be protected in any peace that is negotiated. But yet, she never invites Afghan women themselves to come to the peace table and participate in the negotiations, even though she herself was instrumental in chairing some of the meetings at the UN that have resulted in resolutions advancing, calling for the advancement of women. But she is kind of on her own there in Washington, where, as men keep pointing out to me, the most important meetings are attended pretty much exclusively by men, and the think tanks are staffed pretty much exclusively by men. And so they keep turning out these opinions and plans and strategies and peace policies that are all made up by men, and they involve having certain men talk to certain other men, and then they some of the worst of these plans will say, well, of course, we will have to abandon women here, or we will have to sacrifice some of the gains that women have made, or we will have to forget about the Afghan Constitution. They're ready to, many of these Washington male Afghanistan experts, so-called, are willing to give up on women altogether, whereas the more so-called liberal of these think tankers and policymakers will say, we're making this plan because this will be the best thing that could happen for women, you know. But no man in these think tanks seems to make that great leap to saying, gee, why don't we ask some women to come and tell us how to do this, or what they want, or what they need? It's mind-boggling how united men are, both in Afghanistan and even perhaps even more so in Washington, D.C., on excluding women from a voice in making peace.
Well, you know, it's not that women are, you know, there are some women in Afghanistan who are pretty outspoken. I'm thinking of Malalai Joya.
Well,
she was elected to parliament. I think she was kicked out, though, wasn't she?
She was kicked out for being outspoken. Malalai Joya is one whom many Americans have heard of because of her her outspokenness about the fact that so many men in the Afghan government are warlords and worse, and are some of the most fundamentalist mullahs. Some of them are Taliban. So she spoke out very strongly against them and said that many of them should be on trial for war crimes, not sitting in cabinet offices and in the parliament. And most Afghans would agree with her, absolutely. But she is only one of a great many Afghan women in Kabul and in several of the other cities who are working to try to advance not only the rights of women, but also all those programs that would make life better for everyone, working for better education, better health care, better governance, and so on down the line. And I think it's very important that your listeners realize that women who are working that way in Afghanistan now are doing so under almost constant threat of death. All the women in the parliament are threatened over and over with death, or they're threatened that they will be, that charges of blasphemy will be brought against them by their conservative colleagues. And blasphemy is an offense that's punishable by death in Afghanistan. Women who work for non-governmental organizations, for humanitarian organizations, and so on, regularly get night letters threatening them with death posted on the doors of their offices every day. And many Afghan women leaders have been assassinated since the assassination started in about 2005, and they have continued up to the present. So it is a brave, brave, brave woman who steps forward into these positions in Afghanistan today. Moreover, as I said before, she's backed by the men in her family, and those men are equally brave, because in many cases where assassins could not get to the woman leader they wanted to kill, they killed her husband or her father for not locking her up, for allowing her to go out and work on behalf of women. So, you know, the fact that these women and the men behind them are still carrying forward their efforts to achieve some kind of democracy and greater equality in Afghanistan is really astonishing. And we say that we're there helping them, and yet so much of what we're doing actually puts us in opposition to them.
I was going to ask you that. Do they get any kind of support from the U.S., or is it they, you know, the U.S., you know, why make a big deal out of, you know, supporting women, you know, that woman who had her nose cut off was on the cover of Time magazine, but what kind of real support do they get?
Well, certainly some American aid programs or programs that are partly supported by American aid do some very good work, for example, in improving health care or improving the quality of education and various things of that nature. So it's not that they get that Afghans get no help from the United States. But it has always been true, and it remains true today, that in terms of the dollars that we contribute in humanitarian aid and development aid to Afghanistan, most of that aid, estimates say as much as 86 cents on the dollar, stays in the pockets of Americans who are the contractors or the technical advisors or the extravagantly paid consultants, and a relatively tiny amount of that money actually reaches the Afghan people in any substantial way. And then I think we also have to note this very curious fact that, you know, people get very excited and irate when they see the picture of Aisha on the cover of Time magazine, who has been mutilated because she ran away from her home. And rightly so. Of course we should deplore that and be outraged by it. But why are we so outraged by the mistreatment of this woman's body, and yet we are not outraged by the complete exclusion of women's voices and women's minds from the process of making peace and making the arrangements for the future in the country in which those women have to live and raise their children? Why can't we get as outraged about the misuse of women's minds as we get about the misuse of women's bodies?
Mm. Well, I think that would involve switching our priorities a lot, instead of dealing with these warlord types, going back to the real progressives who may not even be in the country anymore.
Well, many are still there, although mm-hmm. it's certainly true that many are in America and Europe and Australia, and many more will go there if mm-hmm. indeed the wrong kind of peace is made in Afghanistan, as certainly we're seeing threatened now in all this talk of just building up the army and then negotiating between the fundamentalists in Karzai's government and the fundamentalists in the Taliban and calling that a peace. That is not going to work.
Boy.
We have, over the years, made so many mistakes, and this is over the last 30 years or more. We have made so many mistakes. We are in such an impossible situation in Afghanistan, and yet we seem to want to just go forward, just keep going, just keep doing more of the same and spinning this narrative that we are making progress. But nobody can quite define that progress, and it gets harder and harder to say what in the world we're fighting for.
I think we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Ann Jones, author, and A War Is Not Over When It's Over, and a recent article in the Tom Dispatch. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Per. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Okay, stay tuned for Air Cascadia.